We take a look at the week in Washington. The U.S. House has passed a government spending bill. Democrats are facing off in another debate tonight. And the big news is a full week of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The U.S. ambassador to the European Union, a member of the National Security Council, an aide to the vice president, and others have all testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been listening or watching the hearings this week, what sticks out to you? Do the witnesses strike you as credible? Do you have questions about the details of what's happening in this ongoing inquiry? What do you want to see or hear next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, Gordon Sondland, U.S. ambassador to the European Union, someone heavily involved in working with Ukraine, though that's not part of the European Union, testified today. Here's a bit of his opening statement.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Reed, this is 7 hours of testimony. A lot happened today. What were your main takeaways from Gordon Sondland's testimony?
Well, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to equate part of what Gordon Sondland said, especially that little clip you just played, with John Dean's testimony before the House during the Nixon impeachment trial. That Dean's testimony back then, oh so long ago, was the moment when the nation really began to believe that the President Nixon was going to be removed from office. And while I don't think that the Sondland's testimony has changed that much, some of the reactions from Republican senators indicate that it has not changed that much. But this is clearly the moment, I think, when we can say that the president is going to be impeached, if not removed, by the Senate. He'll be impeached by the House. This was some pretty dramatic testimony, and we saw just a revelation after revelation, it seemed like, that tied everybody, every senior official in the administration, from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Vice President Mike Pence to the president himself. And he kept, Sondland kept saying again and again, everyone was in the loop. And that struck me as something that's going to be replayed over and over. I mean, this is a historical day here in Washington.
And let's talk about who Gordon Sondland is. A lot of the previous people giving testimony had worked in D.C. in one capacity or another for a long time. So Republicans said, hey, these are bureaucrats who didn't like President Trump, the swamp, the deep state, whatever. Gordon Sondland's another story. He has been a business person for most of his life. He really only entered diplomacy last year when he was appointed by the Trump administration as this ambassador to the European Union. Does that make it more difficult for Republicans, his background?
Yeah, and not only did he just enter diplomacy, I mean, he was handpicked by President Trump after donating $1 million to the Trump Inaugural Committee. Sondland is a wealthy hotelier whose hotels are based in Portland. He's actually from my hometown of Seattle, but he has started to play a bigger and bigger role in politics, in Republican politics out in the Pacific Northwest. Then he made this big giant donation of $1 million to the Inaugural Committee, and President Trump nominated him to the position of ambassador to the European Union, and apparently they were pretty close. Sondland said that the two of them had multiple conversations by phone. He even intimated that their conversations got a little salty at times, and they could sort of joke back and forth using what he called four-letter words. So that tells you, I mean, this is President Trump later today tried to walk back his own relationship, said he didn't know Sondland very well. But Sondland painted a much different picture on Capitol Hill, and apparently he has the president's personal phone number.
Now, President Trump and some Republicans on the committee highlighted Sondland saying that in one of his phone calls with the president, he asked what Trump wanted from Ukraine. The reply was nothing, no quid pro quo. The president really highlighting that as a defense, saying he wasn't asking for anything. Others pointing to the timing of this. This was almost a month after the initial whistleblower complaint, news filtering out about its existence. What's the back and forth on that particular statement?
Well, look, the president has said all along that he didn't ask for a quid pro quo, and it may be true that he didn't say those exact words to Gordon Sondland. And as a matter of fact, the committee chairman, Adam Schiff, made the point that, you know, you don't have to say the actual words for a quid pro quo to exist. Gordon Sondland believes it existed. He said several others had been read into this, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and even Vice President Mike Pence. Now, Pence's officials have denied that in the last few hours, but he has implicated a lot of people today in what Sondland has described as a pretty obvious quid pro quo. The request for the Ukrainians to publicly say that there were going to be these investigations into the Bidens and their relationship with this Ukrainian business in exchange for a White House meeting and eventually for security funding.
And there's one statement about pressure on the Ukrainian president. Sondland said, I'm quoting here, he had to announce the investigations. He didn't have to actually do it, as I, Sondland, understand it. So making the point that the announcement of investigations was what they were searching for, at least, again, according to Sondland himself.
Which ties this back to the fact that the president was seeking a favor for political purposes rather than some kind of altruistic way of cutting down corruption with Ukraine. That was another pretty significant moment, I thought, when, you know, Sondland acknowledged that the investigation was not about rooting out corruption. It was about damaging a political opponent. And frankly, if an investigation is announced and it is conducted, or even if it's not conducted, it's just the fact that it's announced, that gets repeated on American television media. I was in Iowa a couple of weeks ago talking to voters, and I talked to a couple of Democrats who were saying, yeah, this Ukraine stuff sounds really sketchy about Vice President Joe Biden, even though the allegations of impropriety have been debunked again and again, and he's never been accused of any actual impropriety.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics, including the ongoing impeachment inquiry. And join in with your thoughts on what you've seen and heard at 800-642-1234. We also had a full slate of testimony yesterday, including from Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, member of the National, or a staffer at the National Security Council, who was on that July 25th call between Presidents Trump and Zelensky of Ukraine. Here he is talking about his reaction to learning that investigations were being sought while military aid was being held up.
Frankly, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was probably an element of shock that maybe in certain regards, my worst fear of how our Ukraine policy could play out was playing out, and how this was likely to have significant implications for U.S. national security.
Reed, what stuck out to you from Vindman's testimony?
Vindman was, his very physical appearance is what stuck out to me. He showed up in full dress uniform, which is what a military officer is supposed to do when he or she testifies before Congress. He established himself as an incredibly credible witness right off the bat, and someone who has a deep faith in this country. I mean, he even went as far as to address his father, an immigrant from the Soviet Republic, or from the Soviet Union, and said, "Dad, you know, the reason I'm testifying here is because this is America where right wins out." I can't remember his exact phrasing, but that was powerful. I mean, here is an immigrant whose parents fled the Nazis and the Soviet Union to come to the United States, and has now served his country, including receiving a Purple Heart for his time in Iraq. And here he is testifying that the president of the United States asked for an investigation into a political opponent. He is a direct witness to the initial complaint that the whistleblower brought up, and verifies a number of the facts within that complaint. And I thought it was a remarkable moment, especially just the physical sight of him sitting there with a Purple Heart on his chest, testifying before Congress.
More testimony coming up still this week. A big part of the story is who's not testifying. Who are some of the key figures that Congress would be interested in talking to that haven't been made available by the White House?
Well, we haven't heard anything from Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, who seemed to indicate that he might be willing to testify. At some point, he joined a lawsuit that basically sought to figure out whether or not officials from the White House could be compelled to testify by Congress or could be blocked by President Trump. John Bolton is another party to that lawsuit. Mulvaney, I should say, eventually withdrew from that suit. But John Bolton, the former national security advisor, is still a part of that suit and is supposedly willing to testify if a court will allow him to. Now, Bolton seems to have the timeline is a little hazy here, but Bolton's departure from his White House position earlier this year came right around the time when some of the security assistance may have been held up. Bolton's attorney has hinted that he knows of substantial events in this calendar that would add to Congress's understanding of just what happened. So if he testifies, he is likely to shed some light on this. And by the way, I should say there's an irony here, too. The Democrats have loathed John Bolton and his foreign policy influence over the Republican Party for decades now. And if he ends up becoming sort of the, you know, another bombshell in favor of the Democratic impeachment of a Republican president, that there's going to be a substantial sort of irony in the universe there.
We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Coming up tonight, Reed, a Democratic presidential debate. Still plenty of candidates in this race. What are you watching for in the news lately that might change what happens tonight on stage?
Well, I'm really watching what is happening in Iowa and New Hampshire in terms of who's got the momentum. I mean, here we are. We're only about 2 months away from the Iowa caucuses, about 2.5 months away from the Iowa caucuses, which kick off the first round of voting. And in polls this week, we've seen a new front runner in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and that's South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He has leapt to the lead in polls in both places, and he has become sort of the alternative to former Vice President Joe Biden in that sort of moderate establishment lane, if you will. I'm going to watch how he handles the front-runner mantle. Is he going to he's going to face the slings and arrows from his fellow Democrats. How does he weather that? This is somebody who's been on a national debate stage only four times before in the four previous debates that Democrats have held. It feels like a lot more than five debates, doesn't it? But is he going to sort of collapse under the pressure of the national spotlight, or can he hold his own? The other thing I'm watching for is who emerges from the progressive lane as the real front runner, if you will. Elizabeth Warren has been the leader of that within that sort of segment of the party for most of the year now. What's Bernie Sanders going to do? Bernie Sanders has among the most committed fans of any candidate in the Democratic Party, but there aren't that many of them. You know, everybody I've talked to in Iowa, New Hampshire, who says that they are a Sanders supporter now, says that they were a Sanders supporter 4 years ago, too. That tells me he's not really grown his base much beyond the sort of solid core of fandom. Where does he grow? Will he go after Elizabeth Warren, who is in fact a good friend of his, or will Warren come after him and try to take some of his base too? So I'm watching sort of those two lanes here, those two matchups, if you will: Biden versus Buttigieg, Harris versus Sanders versus Warren, and we'll see who emerges as sort of the top of the heap at the moment. So far this year, Warren and Buttigieg have been the two best debaters on stage, I think, by a country mile.
And polls at this point have misled us before. We've seen people in crowded fields kind of rise and fall before any single votes are cast. Do you see a lot of room for movement up and down before the Iowa caucuses?
Oh, certainly, certainly. You talk to any Iowa voter, and they don't tell you who they're backing. They give you the list of the three or four candidates that they're actively considering. And to the point at which the best-known pollster in Iowa, a woman named Ann Selzer, actually asked people, who's your first choice, who's your second choice, and who are you actively considering? She comes up with an index that shows people's sort of growth potential. And the thing that has leapt out at me is that the two people who have the best growth potential and have for a very long time now are Warren and Buttigieg. Even when they didn't lead the pack, they were on the most people's list. And there's a bizarre anecdote. There's a little coffee shop in Des Moines where the entire political class gets their coffee in the morning before they head out doorbelling. and that the house next door that has the owners, the car out front has a Buttigieg sticker and a Warren sticker. So presumably you got one fan of one and one of the other in that household. But that tells you a little bit about just how sort of how broad Iowans' perspective is. And yeah, I remember back in 2003 at this point, you know, this was Howard Dean's race to lose, and he was running tough against Dick Gephardt. Well, those two spent the last 2 months of the campaign going after each other, and John Kerry and John Edwards finished first and second. So yeah, you're right. A lot can change.
Well, a couple candidates with nothing but growth potential because they're just getting into the race. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is in. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is in, I think-ish. What do you make of them getting into the race?
Well, I think it's a reflection of a worries that former Vice President Joe Biden is not the candidate that people thought he was. It is... You know, both Patrick and Bloomberg come in from the sort of moderate wing of the Democratic Party. Patrick complicates things for Elizabeth Warren a little bit because they may share a voter base. I mean, there are a lot of people from Massachusetts who voted for the same people or the same, you know, both of them. And then, of course, they are both very well known in neighboring New Hampshire. Michael Bloomberg is an interesting case because he has spent more money on American politics than I think anybody else in the last 2-3 years. You know, he spent more than $100 million on Democrats' chances, Democratic candidates and political action committees in the 2018 midterm elections. You know, if he's in the race, spending a lot of money on himself, you know, that's a big hole that Democrats need to fill funding-wise. Now, in the meantime, Bloomberg has said he'll spend something like $100 million on digital advertisements against President Trump. And now just today, he announced he'd spend a lot more on voter registration drives as well. So he's signaling that this is about more than just himself. But this is clearly the sort of business moderate wing of the Democratic Party that is having a bit of a freak out that Joe Biden is not the candidate that he was or the candidate that they thought he was, and that they need somebody who can pull the debate to the right away from sort of the Warren Harris wing or the Warren Sanders wing of the party that is much more concerned with you know, taxing the wealthy.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Heading back over to Congress, yesterday the U.S. House passed a spending bill to keep the government running for a whole 4 more weeks. This goes to the Senate now. So what's up? Why are we again passing short-term spending bills?
Well, they can't agree on a few provisions, and those provisions sort of keep changing which ones are the sticking points. But this has been a problem. You know, in the middle of an impeachment inquiry, President Trump has suggested a few times that he may just shut down government. Now, of course, Congress wouldn't shut down if the government does shut down, but this is not exactly what you want to be doing, you know, a year before you're running for re-election. Congress has not been able to agree to a long-term funding bill. But then again, we've seen this movie a lot of times before. People threaten to cancel Christmas vacation and stuff like that. And then at the last minute, everybody comes together and passes a bill and basically punts the ball another 6-8 months down the road. So that's really what I expect to happen. But yeah, there are still sticking points.
That is what happens, except when it doesn't. We have gotten to that shutdown point, or, you know, the partial shutdown technically before, but you're not seeing that as likely this time around?
No, I don't think so. The issues on which they're disagree or have yet to come to an agreement are just not big enough for a massive shutdown. It is not in anybody's political interest to shut down the government right now, especially during the middle of a primary season, during the beginning of a presidential campaign. This is not in anybody's interest. They will come to a deal. That's my prediction. Although you're right, I mean, this has happened before, and we've gone into January, including this January. Well, no, wait, last January. This January, where we did have, you know, a couple of weeks of a shutdown. This year has been a hell of a decade, hasn't it?
Yeah, the time does fly. The border wall, that's been a sticking point in a lot of recent both immigration bill efforts and funding bill efforts. Is that one point of contention, funding for the border wall that President Trump has been talking about?
Yeah, that's always the case. President Trump wants to be able to talk about the length of border wall that has been built during his presidency. The actual length of new wall that's been built is close to zero, 0 miles, 0 feet. And most of the reconstruction that's taken place has been on old sections of the wall. The Democrats in the House are not going to budge on that. They do not want, they have never been interested in building a wall or increasing the wall along the Mexican border. And they have not been, they're not terribly interested in giving President Trump a political win to fire up his base right before an election. So, you know, President Trump has been calling this Congress the do-nothing Congress, and, he's kind of got a point.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.